This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, February 9th, 2011. I'm Kyle Kellums. Let's just say this winter weather system has lived up to the hyperbole. Historic, if not unprecedented, snowfall totals have fallen throughout the region since early this morning. Schools, businesses, events have all been canceled in the wake of this storm. David Jankowski is with the National Weather Service in Tulsa.
We've had some moderate to heavy bands of snowfall that have set up across portions of eastern Oklahoma and are currently moving across northwest Arkansas. We've had reports anywhere from 12 to 20 inches across a good portion of northwest Arkansas, right along the Arkansas-Oklahoma border so far this morning. And additional snowfall will continue to fall through the morning, maybe into the early afternoon hours as the system pushes eastward.
He says the area could see locally higher amounts. Little Rock and Russellville still under a winter storm warning. That's going to remain in effect until 6 this evening for central Arkansas, along with those of us here in northwest and western Arkansas. David Jankowski with the Weather Service says the storm is due to a strong upper-level low pressure system that moved from the Pacific Northwest through the Rockies and over the Oklahoma and Texas panhandles. And it's expected to continue to create problems and push north and eastward today, moving into the Ohio and Tennessee River Valley. Bitter cold is expected behind this winter storm for at least a day.
Behind the system tonight, we're looking for temperatures at least across northwest Arkansas to be kind of right around the lower single digits to near 5 below 0. Starting tomorrow, we're going to start to see a little bit of a warming trend start to ensue. Temperatures for highs on Thursday getting into the lower 30s. And then by Friday, mid to upper 30s. And then Saturday, kind of mid to upper 40s.
That's David Jankowski with the National Weather Service in Tulsa. And almost everything is affected by this kind of snowstorm in this region. Cities, airports, and hospitals have to go into emergency planning when such a winter storm is in the forecast. This morning, I reached David Cameron, the city administrator in Siloam Springs, at his office. He lives 3 miles away and has a four-wheel drive vehicle. I asked him if there is anything a city can do to prepare for such a winter storm.
Absolutely. I mean, like you have the traditional way you go out and put a brine mixture down on the street. But probably like what we did is we contacted outside, like our local contractors that are not in the construction world right now, that their equipment is sitting there not making money. And you get every piece of equipment that you can moving and have them mobilized immediately and utilize all the sources you can. And for us, that's kind of what we did. The crews got out at 2 o'clock this morning. We have other groups. We had just on standby, ready to go. And, you know, when they say 4 to 8 inches, you plan for something like that. When you see 15 to 20, I mean, it's all hands on deck. I mean, I've got guys from my wastewater plant running backhoes, people from maintenance shops, people have a backhoe out at the cemetery department, the parks department. It's very nice to watch a crew just go at it for a common reason and forget their department for a while. And that's how you attack it.
Is this an opportunity? You know, we live in cynical times. Is this an opportunity for a city to show, you know what, city government can work?
Yeah, absolutely. I believe it. I believe we are public servants. And in a time like this, this is where you are to serve the community the best you can. It's to be out there and putting your best foot forward in these types of situations to demonstrate it's not just when it's all normal that you have these resources available and you have this equipment. It's times like this. And I believe for us, I encourage people, if they cannot make it in, to do it. But it's just amazing how many people I've got in the city today. I've got a very large staff here to answer telephones. It's just to receive it when someone calls. Yeah, I believe it's your opportunity to demonstrate why you're there, other than just the routine day.
Finally, can a winter like this, when you've had 3 or 4 storms that require extra work, can this take a hit on the budget?
Absolutely. We already exceeded, our rock salt budget and different things. But what the guys have always done, and historically, they'll absorb it some way in their budget. And if not, they have declared some of this an emergency. We'll request funding either way. But we've actually had to haul in material from Little Rock as we ran out of salt and sand twice. It's very unprecedented. I've never seen it here.
David Cameron is city administrator at Siloam Springs. Thank you very much for your time.
Hey, thank you.
And as the snowfall amounts continue to grow throughout KUAF's listening area, problems have developed for some people. The Arkansas National Guard is currently assisting stranded drivers on Interstate 540, which has been closed down. Captain Christopher Heathscott is Public Affairs Officer with the Arkansas National Guard.
Well, as far as the National Guard goes, last night in preparation for this incoming storm, we were tasked to activate about 40 of our troops with 18 military vehicles to assist with the possible need to help a stranded motorist up and down the interstates. When the weather came in this morning, it came in kind of hard and fierce and eventually led to, the way I understand it, is Interstate 540 is now closed. And so this resulted in the task to provide an additional 10 soldiers and 10 vehicles to assist the Arkansas State Police Troop L out of Springdale in order to assist them in accomplishing their mission of law enforcement. So we've got one trooper per vehicle going up and down I-540 in order to support their mission.
And if the situation grows worse in other parts of the state, other support will be brought in to help.
Well, right now we've got troops on standby in Russellville, Fort Smith, Fayetteville, and Conway, Malvern, and at the Little Rock Air Force Base. We got teams of six soldiers and airmen per team, but they are currently still on standby with the mission there at 540 being the most serious in the state.
That's Captain Christopher Heathscott, Public Affairs Officer with the Arkansas National Guard. Of course, this sort of weather creates headaches for anyone trying to travel or anyone involved with helping you travel. That includes people at airports. This morning, I reached John Parker, the director of the Fort Smith Regional Airport, and asked him what happens there in preparation for a winter storm like this.
Anytime that a weather event is forecast, we always check all of our equipment. We check that everything is operational, everything is serviced, spare parts are available, say, for example, on our plows and brooms, that extra bristles and extra cutting edges are on hand for everything that we expect as an expendable during the operation. Then we also schedule our manpower so that we can get the greatest value for the time period that we expect to have everybody operational, then make sure that logistics are in place for the event. Make sure your tanks that you fuel all your vehicles from are topped off and are full of fuel so that it's available to you for the length of the operation. And food and drink is pre-positioned for the people that are going to be operating equipment. And then in this event, we didn't know exactly how long it was going to be, so we made room arrangements if we need them at the end of the night after we did everything to a point where we can assure that everything is safe on the airfield. It may be too late and the roads may be too bad for our staff to get home. So those are the kind of preparatory steps we take.
What has it been like so far this morning as the snow continues to come down?
We operate based on keeping a particular standard for our runways and taxiways. And, of course, at a terminal like ours, we have commercial service airport or commercial service aircraft at one side of the terminal, and that ramp space needs to be where the airlines can operate. And then on the other side of that terminal building is where the general public comes and goes from the terminal building. So that has to be maintained as well. Entrance roads, parking lots, sidewalks, and all that has to be maintained and safe as well.
You sound as if you're outside. Where are you right now?
I'm actually operating a piece of equipment on the runway.
Well, stay safe. Best of luck, and thanks for your time.
Oh, most certainly.
That's John Parker. He is the director at the Fort Smith Regional Airport. I talked to him earlier this morning. This is Ozarks at Large. Yesterday, before the winter storm moved in, voters in Carroll County decided to repeal an ordinance passed last summer by the County Quorum Court to create a public facilities board charged with building a rural water system. Carroll County is one of the last counties in the state without rural water. Critics said the board would be too autonomous and that a majority of county residents didn't want a rural water system. Turns out a majority of Carroll County voters agreed with them. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich has this report.
28,000 people occupy around 11,000 homes in Carroll County. More than half live out in the countryside. For 5 years, a small group of developers and business owners who live in eastern Carroll County have been trying to figure out a way to build a rural water system to boost their projects, drawing water via a constructed pipeline connected to Beaver Lake Water District, which serves the cities of Eureka Springs, Berryville, Green Forest, and Harrison. Last August, members of the County Quorum Court voted to enact an ordinance establishing a public facilities board to oversee a rural water system. But this autumn, Pat Matsoukas, a resident of Eureka Springs, circulated an initiative petition to kill the ordinance, collecting over 1,200 signatures for a ballot measure, saying the entity would be subject to no oversight by the state, could declare eminent domain, and have its assets sold at will. A special election was held yesterday, Tuesday, February 8th, with 869 residents voting to keep a public facilities board, 1,286 voting against it, out of 14,000 registered voters. Pat Matsoukas.
And the best part was is that the weather, although the roads were slick, people were able to get in from various places and made it a point to go vote. It's mind-boggling how many obstacles were in the way, and yet people did it. They made the effort to turn out to vote. It's unbelievable. I sit here awed today.
Awed because a group of concerned citizens were able to prevent what they consider a bad ordinance to move forward.
I think the biggest concern was lack of accountability, that people felt this was such a big project that there was no way that we could entrust five people to understand how the whole thing works, and they didn't have a plan. The Public Facilities Board never came forth with a plan. They came forth with good energy saying this is our intention, but we all know that intention has a way of changing. And so I think people were uncomfortable with that and didn't want to give away another piece of the American pie for whatever it's worth.
The Public Facilities Board chair and members tried to sell their pie at four town hall meetings held in recent months, but still a majority of Carroll County residents decided against it. The Public Facilities Board will now disband. And to make sure their interests are met, certain former members say they plan to work with Jimmy Jones, an excavation contractor who lives in eastern Carroll County. In 2008, he registered his own private Carroll Rural Water Association with the Secretary of State's office. This public water authority will be subject to the Arkansas Natural Resources Commission, but not to the will of the voters. Reporting for Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
Allow us now to take you away from February for a few minutes and to Bikes, Blues, and Barbecue in Fayetteville. The annual rally has been drawing hundreds of thousands of bikers and others to the city for a decade. Yesterday, the event's board of directors introduced a new leadership team for BBBQ. Ben Hanford will serve in the newly created position of president and CEO, and Joe Giles has been named the executive director. Originally, the board was seeking just a single person to replace outgoing festival director Nelson Driver. But board president Ken Morton says the board of directors for Bikes, Blues, and Barbecue recently decided to take a new approach.
We decided about 3 or 4 weeks ago that this rally's grown so much that we had to go to the next level or become stagnant. And as a result of that, the board spent many hours trying to decide how to proceed. And I think that we have reached a decision, and I believe very strongly it's the right decision, because we've got to raise additional funds, because we want to get the amount we give to local charities up a hell of a lot more than what we've been doing, and we think we've been doing good.
Morton says that Ben Hanford, the newly hired president and CEO, will be in charge of obtaining more corporate sponsorships and support. Hanford, a native of Batesville, has on his resume past stints as an advance man for the Clinton administration in the White House and a tenure at the United States Chamber of Commerce. After he was introduced yesterday, he explained what the talk of taking the festival to a new level means.
Well, it's just, you know, the organizational aspect. You know, running the rally from a logistical standpoint, that is a huge job in itself. Bringing up the other side, which is the fundraising aspect, we need to step that up. We have, you know, we obviously have a budget for these rallies. We have to cover that. We want to go way beyond that. We want to go way beyond that and give more money to the local charities. That's our goal here.
Joe Giles is a familiar figure in Fayetteville in Northwest Arkansas. He's been making music or introducing other musicians on area stages for years and has been an integral part of past BBBQs. His new role as executive director was described by Giles this way yesterday.
We talked about going to the next level. In my mind, you know, everyone kind of, what's the definition of the next level? You know, is it Sturgis? Is it Daytona? In my mind, for our particular party that we throw in our particular part of the country, it's more for the charities. We are absolutely all about charitable giving and locally charitable giving. And so in my mind, I'm going to throw a better party so that we will have that much more money to give to our charities. We are all committed to it.
Giles says the festival is looking at expansion, but details are few, he admits, because much still has to be planned.
But what we are going to do is throw a better party in terms of the attractions we have here, in terms of the entertainment we have, the terms of the experience that the riders get coming in, and the folks who don't ride, the people who are just showing up to look at the rest of us. We want everybody here to have a better time than they have ever had before, and that's my job.
To expand, that means more people coming?
More people coming.
And, you know, they're Fayetteville being Fayetteville. There are always people who have a lot of different opinions. Some people might shudder when they hear that.
Extremely responsible growth. You know, we don't want to cause problems, but at the same time, we want to do something important economically and charitably for our community. And so, you know, we're here for 4 days. That's not too much to suffer through. And at the same time, it is an awfully lot of fun.
The branding terms the new executives and the members of the board of directors used yesterday were family-friendly and philanthropy. Ken Morton, the president of the event's board of directors, says it is that reputation that can attract more corporate support.
We got to sell our message better to the corporate world that we are the only charitable bike rally in the country, that 100% of the proceeds goes to charity. And we hope some of the large corporations that are involved peripherally in the motorcycle industry will step up like Harley and like Coors Brewing Company and like other people have done. And make larger contributions, which gives us more money to give to charity. Because, you know, we help the battered women, we help a lot of different things around here, and that's our whole goal.
The festival's website says last year it was able to contribute $80,000 in cash to local nonprofits, and an additional $60,000 was raised by local charities through donated booth space at the festival. At the end of yesterday's announcement, Ken Morton threw out the figure of $250,000 as a philanthropic goal for the 2011 event. He says that does mean expansion of the festival, but that expansion will have to be done with an eye on locations other than just downtown Fayetteville.
When we say expand, we realize we're at the point of probably not a whole lot more can spend a lot of time in the downtown area, okay? So the expansion is going to have to take place either in other local communities that we can generate the revenue to give to charity, or maybe larger at the fairground. So we understand that it's not going to be centrally it'll always, hopefully, if the city council and the board, the mayor, allows it, we'll always try to be focused in the downtown area because that's the beauty of our community. I think everybody knows that. But certainly our desire is not to displace the people that don't like it. In fact, we appreciate them putting up with us.
The 2011 Bikes, Blues, and Barbecue Rally is scheduled for September 28th through October 1st. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio, another either brave or silly soul who made it into work today, Jacqueline Froelich from Ozarks Large. Jacqueline, welcome.
I'm bummed. I brought my ski poles. I brought the waxes. I left my skis at home. I was in such a hurry to get here.
That's what happens. Just a few minutes ago, you went out and you measured the snowfall in our parking lot. What do you have for us?
16 inches.
16 inches.
At the level with drifts up to 25 inches.
Now, as people can probably tell from your voice, your accent, you grew up not in the South, but in a place where snow happened more frequently.
With the Jack Pine Savages in northern Wisconsin, yes, sir.
When 16 or 17 inches fell up there, what was that like?
Snowmobile weather.
Okay.
Snowshoeing, not a problem.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for coming in.
You're welcome. Back to the snow.
That's right. This is Ozarks at Large. Late last month, a coalition of organizations, locally and nationally, spent some time explaining an income tax credit for many low-income families called the Earned Income Tax Credit, or EITC. The United Way of Northwest Arkansas organized a local event in Springdale.
The United Way of Northwest Arkansas is honored to have been selected as one of 96 United Way-led tax initiatives nationwide this year through the grant provided by the Walmart Foundation and their partnerships with One Economy and the National Disability Institute.
That's Rachel Osborne from the United Way of Northwest Arkansas. The organization is using the grant money from the Walmart Foundation to spread the word about the Earned Income Tax Credit. The federal tax credit was created in 1975 for low to moderate income households. Karen O'Neill, with the IRS, says it was intended to supplement wages and make work more attractive than federal assistance programs.
As a result of the increases in the Earned Income Tax Credit over the years, it is now the largest federal program targeting the working poor. And last year, more than 26 million families in the country received over $59 billion of Earned Income Tax Credits. And that resulted in lifting over 6.6 million individuals out of poverty.
Karen O'Neill says the money from correctly filing for an EITC can be the single largest amount of money a family receives at one point during a year. The money can mean a down payment for a house or money for college tuition. Last year in Arkansas, more than 314,000 families received the Earned Income Tax Credit, which the IRS says was worth more than $739 million to the state. Again, Karen O'Neill with the IRS.
Families now with three children can receive up to $5,666 in Earned Income Tax Credit. And individuals who or families that do not have children that are low-income workers, such as those with disabilities, are eligible to receive up to $457.
But not every family eligible seeks the tax credit. This year, the United Way in Northwest Arkansas is trying to create more awareness. Last month, the Walmart Foundation gave the United Way that $15,000 check to help that happen. The Internal Revenue Service estimates that while 80% of Arkansans eligible for the EITC file, simply a 5% increase in eligible families getting the credit in every Arkansas county would be worth $24 million more to the state. One way to get some of that 20% not filing for the credit to do so begins with volunteer tax preparers. Mike Rada is the district coordinator in AARP's efforts to provide free tax preparation.
In some ways, it's a real ministry. We have, I've had recent widows come in with tears in their eyes and a shoebox full of receipts. And they say, my husband did these returns for all the years. I don't know what I'm going to do. And it's nice to put your arm around her and say, we'll take care of you. And by the end of the day, they're smiling and relieved, and we've taken care of them. So in a way, it's a ministry, and people are very appreciative for what we do.
He says the AARP will have five locations in Northwest Arkansas this year: Berryville, Fayetteville, Holiday Island, Rogers, and West Fork. The all-volunteer service can only operate as many locations as there are qualified people to run them. Other services, like the Volunteer Income Tax Assistance Program, or VITA, can help prepare returns for free. And advocates for the Earned Income Tax Credit say there is another hurdle. They say too many eligible applicants seek a refund anticipation loan because they're promised their money sooner, though the loan ends up costing an applicant some of their refund. Jennifer Ligori is the program director at Northwest Arkansas Tax Center, an IRS-certified VITA free tax assistance site in Springdale. She says many of the services that offer refund anticipation loans can't deliver money much faster, if at all, than VITA-certified free services.
Currently, because the debt indicator has been taken off by the IRS, they often can't get it any faster by the pay preparers, and then we can. However, sometimes the advertising is misleading. So they are sucked into going down the street from where we are and end up not getting their refund any faster, and then, of course, they pay the fee.
IRS research indicates in 2008 about half of Arkansas's low-income families paid to have their taxes prepared, and about half of those families applied for a refund anticipation loan. To help answer potential questions about taxes and tax preparation, Rachel Osborne of the United Way of Northwest Arkansas says the agency is directing questions to its free 211 service.
For any taxpayer who's interested in the services, whether it's to set up an appointment or just understand more about their resources, they can call 211, and we offer bilingual services in English and Spanish. So it works really well this year to just have a one-stop place for people to go.
And in an effort to make applying for an earned income tax credit even easier, One Economy has developed an application for smartphones. Whatever the method for applying for the earned income tax credit, figures from the IRS show the money for counties in this region are substantial. The latest numbers from the IRS indicate that filers in Washington, Benton, Madison, and Carroll counties combined receive more than $72 million in EITC returns. And qualifiers for the tax credit in Sebastian, Crawford, Franklin, and Johnson counties receive nearly $49 million combined. For more information about the United Way of Northwest Arkansas's efforts to increase awareness about the earned income tax credits, UnitedWayNWA.org. For more information about the AARP's local free tax preparation locations, you can go to AARP.org and put tax help into the site's search engine. And for more information about the Northwest Arkansas Tax Center, that website is NWATaxCenter.org. This is Ozarks at Large.
So far away, doesn't anybody stay in one place anymore?
Singer-songwriter Carole King was born on this date in 1942. While the landmark album Tapestry earned her superstar status, King had already firmly established herself as one of pop music's most gifted and successful composers, with work recorded by everyone from the Beatles to Aretha Franklin. King began playing piano at the age of 4 and formed her first band while in high school. She became a fixture at influential DJ Alan Freed's local rock and roll shows. In the 1960s, she helped write more than 100 chart hits in a vast range of styles, including The Locomotion and You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman. King also continued her attempts to mount a solo career and scored one hit with 1962's It Might As Well Rain Until September. In 1971, she released Tapestry, which stayed on the charts for over 6 years and was the best-selling album of the era. A quiet, reflective work which proved seminal in the development of the singer-songwriter genre, Tapestry also scored a pair of hit singles with So Far Away and the chart-topping It's Too Late. King continued releasing albums through the 70s, and after 1980's Pearls, her last significant hit, King soon moved to a tiny mountain village in Idaho, where she became active in the environmental movement. After 1983's Speeding Time, she took a 6-year hiatus from recording before releasing City Streets. In 2001, she returned with Love Makes the World. 4 years passed before her next record, The Living Room Tour, a double disc set documenting her intimate 2004-2005 tour that found her revisiting songs from throughout her career with only her piano and acoustic guitars as accompaniment.
There's so many dreams I've yet to find.
Clyde Ellis of Garfield, Arkansas, died on this date in 1980. He served in both houses of the state legislature and was the United States Representative for the 3rd District from 1939 to 1943. Ellis vigorously promoted the cause of rural electric co-ops and was the first general manager of the National Rural Electric Cooperative Association, a New Deal agency designed to bring electricity to rural America. He was widely seen as the greatest advocate of rural electrification in the United States. The U.S. Weather Bureau was created on this date in 1870. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, the 9th day of February 2011, a day not many of us will forget for a long time. Historic snowfall amounts. The National Weather Service has just recently said that the winter storm warning is still in effect until 6 o'clock this evening for the KUAF listening area. Snow totals between 1 and 2 feet likely in areas from Pawhuska, Oklahoma to Jay, Oklahoma to Fayetteville to Huntsville, up to 24 inches. Dangerous wind chills between 0 and 10 below will be common. If you go outside, remember to wear proper clothing to protect the skin from frostbite. Travel will remain dangerous to nearly impossible across much of northeast Oklahoma and northwest Arkansas, where the heavier snow is falling. In addition to that, stiff north winds will cause blowing and drifting of snow. Snow drifts of over 4 feet have already been reported in some locations. Many roads are impassable. Think twice before going out in all of this. And if you are staying in for the duration of this winter storm, here's a little respite for you. There's a new digital poetry anthology available, edited and created by local poets. 2 weeks is available at the website linebreak.org, and soon will also be available through amazon.com. The name of the collection, 2 weeks, is an appropriate title. The entire project took just 14 days. Organizers sought submissions of poetry, received them, edited them, coded them into digital form, and made the collection available for purchase in just 2 weeks. Jonathan Williams is a co-editor, co-publisher, and co-creator of 2 weeks.
Within that 14-day period, we read all of the submitted poems. We accepted 58 of them in the end. 58 poems got accepted. We edited them, made corrections when necessary, asked for changes when necessary. We got the contracts agreed to. We got the we got audio recorded. Every poem in the book was read and recorded by a contributor other than the author. Which is something we've been doing on our website for a while. And then we got the ebook coded and put together and out the door.
Why 2 weeks? Why challenge yourself like that?
Part of it, we've been doing a website for like 2 years. It's called Line Break, where we do a poem a week. And that format seemed to work really well. You know, a poem a week, and that weekly seemed to give... it gave each poem that's published a nice amount of attention, or whatever. So, when we'd been wanting to do a book project for the longest time and could never, the original idea was to do a print book, you know, standard book of poems. But one thing and another, you know, there's always a reason not to do something like mm-hmm. that, especially when, you know, we all have day jobs and our own writing to do. An insane deadline sounded like just the thing to make us do it. And since we'd already been doing a weekly, we thought, well, probably can't do a book in a week, but maybe 2 weeks.
How did you ask? Where did you go to seek submissions?
Well, we couldn't have done it if we didn't already have, you know, linebreak.org, the website that we've been doing for the last 2 years. So through that, you know, we already knew quite a few poets, and we knew quite a few people who ran other poetry magazines or poetry-related websites. So we put this announcement on our website, and then just for the next week, because we only took submissions for that first week. They were closed after that first week. And for the next week, just pretty much annoyed everyone we knew through Facebook and Twitter and email. And we have an email list associated with the website we run. So there was, you know, there were 800 names right there, 800 people right there we could tell. But we were really fortunate in that lots of other people picked it up and posted it. They reposted it on Facebook, or they, like, you know, the Poetry Foundation, which does Poetry Magazine, was nice enough to put a note on their website that we were doing this. And lots of people did that who ran websites, just posted a note. So in the end, 408, I think, might have been the exact number, submitted poems. And most of them submitted more than one poem. So we had more than 1,000 poems to read in a week. And that made for some really interesting nights, you know, 3 a.m.
Did you ever feel that maybe you weren't the poems you were first seeing at 3 a.m., you weren't maybe giving the same sort of attention to the poems you saw at 7
p.m.? Absolutely, and I know that happened. As a matter of fact, once it was over, I went back through, and the people who submitted are going to hate hearing this, but once it was over, I went back through and, you know, read some things that we rejected and thought, yeah, that might not have been the best decision in the world. But that, I mean, I kind of knew, I knew there would be some slippage. I mean, I knew, you know, it wasn't going to be perfect. You do something like this in 2 weeks, you're going to make mistakes. And we did. And, you know, that was one of them, just that was among them. That sort of second-guessing yourself and what you took or didn't take.
I mentioned at the beginning your co-editor. We should give credit to...
Ash Bowen. Yeah, Ash Bowen. So this was more or less a two-man project. It was myself and Ash Bowen, who also works on Line Break, the website, with me. He's also a graduate with the MFA program here and a fine poet in his own right. And at the last minute, we were joined by two of our other co-editors from the website, Ashley McHugh and Jennifer Jabaley Blackburn. Came to my house Monday night, sort of the night before we'd agreed to get this thing out the door, when I realized there was absolutely no way that Ash and I could get this thing edited in any sort. Because I was coding this up, learning to sort of code ebooks as I was coding this up that night. And
this was the first ebook you'd ever coded?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it was the first time we'd done it. We were doing it that night, and it got to be about 7 o'clock, and I realized, number one, I was not going to bed at any point, you know, that this was just going to be an all-nighter. And number two, that just the two of us, you know, there was no way we could maintain the kind of proofreading and editorial quality we wanted. So I called them in kind of a panic, and they graciously came over. And we set up laptops and, you know, two or three computers, three, I think it was, at my kitchen table, and got a bunch of Red Bull and a bunch of coffee. And toward the end, maybe a little beer. Yeah, knocked it out.
Who do you think will see this? I mean, if you have the website... linebreak.org, which I think is probably frequented by many people who are poets.
Yes.
You sought out poets you knew via social media. Do you hope that this ebook, which is for under $5 online, gets in the hands of poets or can break through somehow and get to people who have never written a line of poetry?
Well, I mean, yeah, the hope is always that it won't be just poets reading it. I mean, I'm happy that poets are reading it. I mean, I've already heard back from some of them. And that's a great audience to have, but... The hope we always had with Line Break, and I think sort of the great hope of, I don't know, digital publishing in general, is that you get beyond just the audience of poets and beyond just the audience of, you know, just the sort of academic circles that poetry largely travels in now. That's happening to a degree. I think it'll happen a lot more once the book gets listed on Amazon, which should be any day now. It'll be available. You can just buy it from them. I mean, I've always thought... Like ever since I got the MFA, that's kind of the great problem that poetry has now, is that it is largely read by poets, which is to say it's largely read inside of universities, because that's where poetry has sort of sequestered itself in the last few decades.
You took special care to make sure the poems look like the way the poets wanted them to look?
Yeah, this was another reason I wanted to do the ebook in the first place, is because, I'll just give them both barrels, I guess, is because publishers of poetry, the few that had done ebooks at all, were just, they're screwing them up. And they're screwing them up in that what all publishers, and not just publishers of poetry, but what all publishers want, insofar as they're interested in ebooks at all, but what all of them want is to just take, you know, the thing that they prepare for print, you know, the file that they prepare on their computers for print, and push a button and have it spit out an ebook. Great, and now we'll sell an ebook. But you can't do that. You can't do that for the same reason you can't just take like a document and have and push a button and have a great web page made out of it. Right. You know, you still need someone who's technically competent enough to sort of make that, to transform it. And poetry in particular with ebooks is a real challenge because, of course, poems are dependent on line breaks. And the thing about ebooks is you never know how wide the screen is that you're going to be reading something on.
Because it could be on my smartphone.
Exactly.
It could be on my laptop.
Exactly. iPad.
iPad. It may even be on my 56-inch screen television at home.
Precisely. I mean, there is no page anymore. There's only how much information happens to fit on the screen you happen to be reading the ebook on. So in order to fortunately, I mean, poetry has been dealing with that for decades at least, and you know, they have a system. When a line is too long for the page, not to get too sort of geeky on the listeners here, but when a line is too long for the page, when it needs to wrap, you know, you signify that that's not an intended line break by indenting the part of the line that wraps. Right. So, you know, it wraps onto that second line, and you just indent it over, and that tells the reader that's not a natural line break. That just happened to overflow the width of the page. And the good news is you can do that on a screen. In an ebook, you can code them so that they do the same thing, so that lines that wrap do the same thing. But you do have to code it. You do have to take each poem and go through it, as far as I know, by hand. I mean, that's the way that I did it. Decoded every single poem to make sure that they would do that. And a lot of poetry publishers just have not done that. And so what happens is, you know, those few books of poetry that are available, for instance, on the Kindle right now, relatively few, you know, compared to the number you can get in print. Most of the ones that I've seen, you open them up and they're just a mess. You just don't know where the natural line breaks are. You don't know how to read them.
And that changes the entire poem.
Yeah.
Or the intent.
Of course, it changes the entire poem and often just ruins it.
Well, congratulations on the book.
Thank you very much. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. Not sure I would ever do it again in that short a time, but it was a great learning experience.
So we're not going to see 7 days.
No, I don't think I would survive an anthology called 7 days.
Was there ever discussion among anyone to call it Fortnite instead of 2 weeks?
No, there wasn't. That, which maybe, you know, shame on us for being poets and not thinking about that.
No, I think it's okay.
It's not the most creative title in the world, but hopefully it encapsulates the project. And, you know, and like gimmick aside, I just want to say there are amazing poems in this book and amazing poets in this book. And
if 2 weeks didn't exist yet, where would these poems – Who would be able to see many of these poems?
You wouldn't. I mean, they're all original. You know, I'm sure they would have eventually been published in places like Line Break and mm-hmm. other journals and magazines. But they're previously unpublished, you know, all new poems. So if we hadn't done the book, at least at the moment, they wouldn't be readable at all.
Jonathan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jonathan Williams helped create the new digital poetry collection, 2 Weeks. You can learn more about the book and purchase it digitally at the website linebreak.org. Also there, you can hear samples of the poems read by contributors to the book. This is Ozarks at Large.
Hey, I'm Michael Feldman. Nothing funny in the news? Think again.
Of 10 billion Apple apps, 37 are currently in use. That's the best one being that beer-pouring one that Aubrey has. iPad will add iWallet for ease of iHand. Steve Jobs is on iHeart and iLung. Chuckle along with me this week on Michael Feldman's What Do You Know? From PRI, Public Radio International.
What Do You Know with Michael Feldman? Saturday morning, beginning at 10 on KUAF 91.3 FM. Saturday's forecast, sunshine, highs around 50 throughout the KUAF listening area. Of course, we have some time between now and then. Tonight's forecast, cloudy early, then clearing, and very, very cold tonight. Lows in the Arkansas River Valley around 5. Lows tonight in northwest Arkansas, 4 below zero. Tomorrow, sunny, warming up. Highs will be in the upper 20s for the Arkansas River Valley. A little bit warmer tomorrow in northwest Arkansas, with highs right around 32. Thursday night, clear and cold again, but not as cold. Lows Thursday night, 8 to 13 degrees. Friday, sunshine, highs in the upper 30s, and then that Saturday forecast, sunshine, highs close to 50. The Fort Smith Museum of History will be celebrating the 100th birthday of the illustrious World War II hero General William O. Darby this Saturday. At least that's the schedule right now. During his 12 years in the U.S. Army, General Darby won many medals and accolades. The museum hopes to raise awareness regarding Darby's contributions among the young and old alike, and Ozarks at Large's Ithi Agnihotri-Madulker has this report.
Only 34 when he passed away, Fort Smith's very own World War II hero General William Orlando Darby received 3 Purple Hearts, 2 Distinguished Service Crosses, the Silver Star, the Legion of Merit, the Russian Order of Kutuzov, and the French Croix de Guerre. The city will celebrate his 100th birthday on Saturday. Lisa Gremlich, Executive Director of the Fort Smith Museum of History, has the details.
General Darby grew up right here in Fort Smith, attended Fort Smith High School, later attended the United States Military Academy at West Point, New York, and served admirably in World War II and formed the Darby's Rangers, who are very well known worldwide. And his actual birthday is February 8, 1911. But we will celebrate on February 12th, 2011, his what would have been his 100th birthday. He was killed in action on April 30th, 1945, in Italy.
Lisa hopes the event will help raise awareness about General Darby's contributions to his nation. The celebration will begin at 1 in the afternoon.
At 1 p.m., we will celebrate with birthday cake and punch in the museum's old-fashioned soda fountain. And then at 2 p.m., there will be a special program by Darby Watkins, who is a nephew of General Darby. He has done vast research and is working on a manuscript, and he will share his research with us.
The event is free with museum admission, which is $5 for adults and $2 for children. Admissions for children under 6 years old are free.
This is will be held at the Fort Smith Museum of History at 320 Rogers Avenue in Fort Smith. The birthday party itself with cake and punch will be held at 1 p.m. in the museum's soda fountain. And then in the museum's William O. Darby Memorial Room will be the program with Darby Watkins at 2 p.m.
More information about General William O. Darby's 100th birthday celebration is available on www.fortsmithmuseum.com. For Ozarks at Large, this is Iti Agnihotri Mutholkar.
Local support for Ozarks at Large comes from Arcom Printing, located east of the Township and College intersection in Fayetteville. Arcom Printing provides printing, copying, and digital output services. ArcomPrinting.com or 444-7711 for more information. According to our research this morning here at KUAF, the record snowfall for February 9th in Fayetteville is 4 inches. We will officially declare that we have broken at least that daily record. The good news is, quick check of power outages from Carroll Electric, Ozarks Electric, and SWEPCO is showing about a dozen homes right now without power in southern Benton County, something to be thankful for there. Ozarks Electric and SWEPCO at this point showing no power outages. A winter storm warning remains in effect until 6 o'clock tonight for the KUAF listening area. Again, very cold tonight. Lows in the single digits in the Arkansas River Valley. Lows below zero, around 40 for much of northwest Arkansas. Please be careful. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks so much for tuning in. We'll have another new edition of Ozarks at Large tomorrow at noon. Have a warm Wednesday.